In the coming week, Israel holds its fourth election in 2 years. The U.S. faces a mounting migration crisis at its border with Mexico, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel meets with regional premiers. It's March 18th, 2021, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, Israel is going to be holding elections again in the coming week. This election will be the fourth time Israelis have gone to the polls in just the last 2 years. Now, each of these elections, if I recall, were razor thin in terms of the outcomes. And a couple of those occasions, it did not produce a government. The last one did. It was a unity government between Benny Gantz's Blue and White Coalition and Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud Party. Jim, can you tell us what's going on now? Why are the Israelis heading back to the polls again?
Certainly, Bob. Let's begin with why the Israelis are going to be voting next Tuesday. The simple explanation is that Israel's unity government fell apart last December over the failure to pass a budget. And under Israeli election rules, new elections had to be held within 3 months. The big question is, why didn't the unity government hold together? Why did it fail to reach agreement on a budget? The most commonly offered explanation is that Prime Minister Netanyahu engineered the collapse because he saw an opportunity to run and win big in fresh elections. Now, I think it's important to keep in mind that Netanyahu faces a trial for charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. And the speculation has been that if he could succeed in forming a new right-wing government over which he had greater control, that that would be his best bet for engineering some kind of immunity or delay in court proceedings. Now, as we look at the election next week, I think the easiest prediction to make is that no single party is going to win 61 seats outright in the Knesset. Now, you need to get 61 seats if you want to form a majority of the Israeli parliament. The real question is, can any party or group of parties win enough votes to form a stable majority coalition? And I think here the betting money is that if Israel does get a majority coalition, it'll be a coalition that holds just a very slight majority of seats. That, of course, means that the Israeli government could be vulnerable to defections and potentially paralysis, because whoever ends up as prime minister will need to try to hold all of the parties together. And on a number of issues, these coalitional partners simply won't agree. Now, four candidates look like they have a chance of coming out on top, that is being tabbed with the challenge of putting together a government. One obvious one is current Prime Minister Netanyahu, but there are also leaders of two other center-right parties that could emerge as Israel's next prime minister. One is former Defense Minister Naftali Bennett. Another is former Education Minister Gideon Zar. And there's also a centrist candidate, a gentleman named Yair Lapid. He's a former news anchor, and he has been very popular with a slice of the Israeli electorate. One name I haven't mentioned is Benny Gantz. If the polls are right, he's going to end up with about 6 seats in the new Knesset. That's down from the 30 that his coalition won last time. It's a reflection of the fact that Gantz has been the real loser in the unity government. He had campaigned, people may recall, saying he would never work with Netanyahu. He changed his mind, formed the unity government. He argues it was necessary given COVID, necessary because Netanyahu was moving to annex parts of the West Bank, and he felt that by being in a unity government, he would have greater impact over policy and be able to prevent the prime minister from taking steps that he saw as being contrary to Israel's interests. That may be true. The reality, however, is that it deeply offended most of the people in his coalition, and his popularity has plummeted. Now, of course, the real politicking in Israel is going to take place after the votes are counted next Tuesday. And again, the big question is, can anybody put together a majority coalition? And I think it's important to point out that right-of-center parties are likely to get a majority of seats, but that doesn't mean they're going to be willing to cooperate. Bennett and Zar have both pledged that they will not ally with Netanyahu under any circumstances. And Netanyahu has gotten loyalty oaths from members of his three-party bloc that prevents them from negotiating with Zar or Bennett to form a government. Now, big question is, could minds change? Could people who have said, there's no way I will ally with, suddenly see the incentive to reverse course, perhaps? But I do think that Benny Gantz's experience probably provides an important cautionary tale for any talk of change of heart.
Okay, so we're looking at razor-thin margins yet again in Israel, Jim. What's curious is we have an election at a time in which Israel seems to be riding a crest of esteem, I would say, in terms of the way it's handled the vaccination rollout. One of the highest rates of vaccination in the world, something like 25% of its population. It has continued to try to build on the momentum from its diplomacy that occurred, especially under the Trump administration, in terms of the Abraham Accord. So setting up relations with Arab states, and the Biden administration has indicated it wants to continue that process as well, although it's starting off on a different footing with Netanyahu's government. But does any of those accomplishments feed into the public, especially, I would say, the COVID response, Jim? We've seen a number of elections under COVID. Any sense that that's going to build up and boost Netanyahu?
Prime Minister Netanyahu certainly hopes that his handling of the vaccine is going to be a wind at his back going into the elections on Tuesday. But I think you got to step back and realize that Netanyahu is an immensely polarizing figure in Israeli politics. And I think you can say, in some sense, if you want to sort of do a dividing line through the Israeli electorate, they break it down into two camps, one that's pro-Netanyahu and one that is hostile to Netanyahu. And that sort of drives all of this. Moreover, when you look at Israeli politics, like politics in lots of other countries, the fact that there are policy successes doesn't mean that people agree either on the importance of that success or who should get credit for that success. So you mentioned the Abraham Accords. I think one of the things that someone like Benny Gantz has been arguing is that we actually deserve credit. My decision to join the unity government was important because it prevented Prime Minister Netanyahu from going ahead with his plan to annex parts of the West Bank. And because we prevented him from doing that, that made the Abraham Accords possible. So again, this is always the case in all democratic governments and democratic societies. People can argue over what has happened, who gets the responsibility or the blame for what has happened, but also the reality that people are looking down the road. That is, what do they think is going to happen? We tend to think of politics as being about people sort of looking in the rearview mirror, doling out credit, when in fact, a lot of times people have very short memories, forget about what's happened, and they have some expectation about where they think the country is going to go, where they want it to go. One of the things I don't have a good feel for is to what extent Israelis now are suffering from election fatigue. You mentioned this is the fourth national election in 2 years, or a little bit over 2 years, and Israelis are clearly a deeply divided society, and they're not the only country. Again, look at politics here in the United States, but there's always a question of to what extent people are going to turn out and whether they're going to sort of double down on past preferences or surprise everybody by making a very different choice. Again, a lot of the commentary at this point is based on what people see in polls and how they read polls, but Democratic publics occasionally throw the pollsters a curveball and vote differently than everybody thinks leading in. So I think, again, you have to first see what the vote looks like come next Tuesday, and then the real politicking begins as the various coalition partners try to decide, can you form a coalition or not? Bob, let's turn our attention back to the United States and look at the mounting migration crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. In the last few weeks, Mexico has been struggling to deal with a new wave of migrants expelled from the United States while simultaneously handling an influx of migrants headed north to the border, many of them coming from the countries of Central America. Migrant shelters that were empty several months ago are now having to turn people away, and COVID-19 is adding another layer of complexity to the issue. So tell us more, Bob, about what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Sure, Jim. It is first something that has been mounting over a number of months. You'll recall our conversation with our colleague Shannon O'Neill in our year-end podcast about 3 months ago. She zeroed in on this as possibly the first crisis to face the incoming Biden administration, because there had been many months, even at that point, of an increasing number of migrants seeking to cross the border. And that was under a period of much more restrictive both policies and messaging from the Trump administration. So now what do we have? Well, let's just look at February. Detentions exceeded 100,000 in February. That's almost 30% increase from January. In the Rio Grande Valley alone, that's sort of this main area of crossings, there were about 10,500 family units that arrived in February. That's up from 2,000 in January. And overall, expulsions from over the past year was about 500,000. And some of these, we should note, are the same person being expelled repeatedly. But you also have the circumstance of unaccompanied migrant children, Jim. That's a newer newer development. And under law, they can only be held in facilities, holding facilities for 72 hours. So as of the start of this week, there was something like 4,200 unaccompanied migrant children that will need to be relocated to other residences, or sponsors have to be chosen to oversee them. Basically, the Health and Human Services Department of the U.S. government needs to find a place to humanely situate them. And that is proving to be very difficult. So this is all obviously occurring at a time of a new administration still getting its feet. You had, you know, in the first weeks in office, President Biden ending construction of the wall along the U.S. southern border. It's one of the signature policies of the Trump administration. President Biden canceled the what were called the Safe Third Country Agreements with these countries that are contributing many of these migrants. Not all, but many. And these are countries in Central America known as the Northern Triangle. So Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. And then the president also allowed up to 25,000 asylum seekers that were currently residing in Mexico under the Migrant Protection Protocol to enter the United States as they waited a decision. So a series of moves indicating the U.S. and intentionally indicating the U.S. wanted to more humanely treat migrants, wanted to follow more settled sort of asylum law in helping them to possibly relocate or at least have their cases heard in the United States. All of which sent signals that were certainly picked up and continued to add to what was already a building flow of migrants into the United States, Jim. So now it's a matter of capacity, you know, and really the time needed to sort of field all these, and really tough questions coming from Republicans, but not only Republicans, about whether the Biden administration was too hasty in some of its pronouncements while not being able to back it up with changing facts on the ground to be able to process so many would-be migrants to the United States.
Bob, can you help me understand why this crisis is happening now? I say that because this crisis was easily predicted, in fact, was predicted. I remember sitting down recording an episode of The President's Inbox back in January, talking to experts in Latin America, and they flagged this as one of the looming crises for the Biden administration, that this was likely to happen because the expectation was with Donald Trump leaving the White House and Joe Biden coming in, the United States would be more open to people applying for asylum. And there was, even at that time, advertisements on radio in Central America about going north. These are advertisements put forth by so-called coyotes and other organized trafficking rings. So there was no surprise there. And at the same time, it was pretty clear that should this crisis come about, that Republicans would be all over it. Immigration is a volatile issue here in the United States, and you would expect the Republicans to point to any evidence that the Biden team wasn't strong on borders. I mean, that was a common Republican refrain. Yet we're seeing this happen. Is it a case that the Biden team simply was asleep at the switch and didn't realize that this was a looming problem? Is it that the Biden team was too concerned about alienating members of the progressive left by standing up tougher measures at the border? Is it that the transition was too slow and so that he just didn't get staffed up and didn't have enough people in place? Is it something else? I mean, again, this is one of these things where I've heard experts for weeks and months talk about it, and it has arrived. And again, you would think if you knew it was coming, you would have taken steps to prevent it.
Those are all really good questions, Jim, and it's hard to zero in on any one. I think, like a lot of crises, there are multiple factors and multiple complex challenges. I would say they were, while not being asleep at the switch, they were certainly aware of these problems and had been hearing from it. I do think there's some truth in that they were eager to send a new message on a whole host of policies, but especially the border issues. They had been hearing a lot and had campaigned on it, that they were going to do more to act humanely, to try to zero in on the problems in some of the core countries that have been contributing to this migrant surge, but also to be a country that respected asylum and refugee law and come back to that fold. But again, the scale of it, one would expect the scale of it to be known. I think you might have, in some respects, the unexpected success of the initial top priority of the Biden administration, which was, let's stand up vigorously and aggressively a vaccine distribution program. That seems to be moving forward on track for the most part. And the very success of that, Jim, has sent a further sort of triggering signal perhaps to people who were maybe already motivated to try to come into the United States. And so possibly added to a surge that was already in place and has made this bubble up to the extent that it has and is getting front burner attention. So you have, on top of all of the woes that had been contributing to people seeking to come to the U.S., you have a Biden administration saying, first of all, we're going to let you in to wait your adjudication, or we're going to set up facilities in your home countries that will help you process your cases there. Meanwhile, a great number of these migrants have relatives relatives in the United States, they're certainly hearing from those relatives that they feel like a temperature change has taken place and they should try to come and maybe they can get hosted there. And while everybody's waiting for bureaucracy to process, they can live with their extended family members in the U.S. And so it's a whole host of things, Jim. But back to the initial aspect of being prepared for it, I think if there wasn't a COVID crisis, maybe this could have been job one for the administration to really flood the zone with officials, with resources, with attempts to get this problem under control. Not that any administration can't walk and chew gum at the same time, so to speak, but I think maybe trying to take on all of the different things that they were taking on, they might have overlooked to an extent how big this problem was and will continue to be. And as you say, it's looming as a major political challenge for this administration very early on.
You're certainly right, Bob, that this is and is going to continue to be a major political problem. One of my takeaways from all of this is that this is actually an incredibly difficult problem to solve in ways that people think is fair across a broad range of dimensions. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. The other point I'll make, simply because I think you're going to be hearing a lot about the wall in the Biden administration's errors in stopping building of the wall construction wasn't going to solve this problem. Simply isn't enough of the wall to do anything to stem this problem. So I think it's important to point that out.
Yeah. And I would just add also, Jim, that, you know, one thing that the Biden administration has continued from the Trump administration was something known as Title 42, which allows Border Patrol to expel undocumented migrants to prevent the spread of COVID-19. So that was set in place March of 2020. And the administration continues to be under pressure to ease up on that. But again, ease up and then do what? So I think there are so many layers to this. And as you say, it is incredibly complicated, but it's going to require, I think, you know, the same sense of mission that we're seeing with the vaccine rollout to both put out political fires, deal with the real problem, and try to set in place something that's going to require legislation as well as a heck of a lot of more resources and just, you know, bureaucracy really to be created to deal with this. Jim, let's set our sights on Europe, where German Chancellor Angela Merkel is set to meet with regional leaders via video conference in the coming week to discuss current COVID-19 restrictions, among other things. Could you give a sense of what this meeting is going to be talking about?
Happy to, Bob. I think a little bit of background is in order. Earlier this month, Angela Merkel and the governors of Germany's 16 states agreed to extend a lockdown because of COVID-19 until the end of the month, even as they began easing some restrictions as Germany heads into Easter. And the purpose of this meeting is to discuss possible further relaxation. Could be a very contentious discussion, however, because what Germany is experiencing is a spike in COVID cases. They were up about 20% in the last week. And the country's intensive care doctors have been warning that the country needs to return immediately to at least a partial lockdown to prevent a third wave of the coronavirus. And Germans are particularly worried about the spread of the British variant of the coronavirus, the so-called B.1.1.7 strain. Now, if you look at Germany's performance in handling COVID, it's been essentially middling. Germany has experienced roughly 900 deaths per million in the population. That's much better than the United States, which is about 1,650. And Germany's response is better than most other major European countries, which are all over about 1,400 deaths per million. But if you compare Germany to a country, let's say like Japan, which has 70 deaths per million in the population, obviously Germany's performance hasn't been that good. And in Germany, like in other countries, the debate has been about what are the steps that are best for the economy? How do you handle the potential for new variants? How do you get equity across regions, across social classes, and the like? The real twist in the German debate is this is coming in the midst of what Germans call the Superwahljahr, or the super election year, and I apologize. Apologize to all my German speakers for my butchering of the term. But in Germany, in a super election year, six of the 16 states are holding elections, and then there will be national elections in September. And of course, Chancellor Merkel is leaving the scene after dominating German politics for 16 years. And there's a lot more uncertainty in German politics than there have been in recent years. We had two of the first state contests last weekend, one in Baden-Württemberg and another in Rhineland and Palatinate. These are states that are in the west and southwest of Germany. They're among Germany's wealthiest states. And they had long been a place where Merkel's party, the Christian Democrats, had done well. But in fact, in these two races, the CDU put up their worst numbers going back to World War II. The Greens did well in Baden-Württemberg, think Stuttgart and the auto industry, whereas the Social Democrats won a plurality in Rhineland-Palatinate, which is a state that borders Luxembourg, Belgium, and France. Now, one of the interesting things about those election returns is that the far-right party, the Alternative for Germany, saw its popularity drop from 2016. And so now, as you can imagine, German talking heads and analysts and politicians are all trying to make sense of what the election results mean. Are these one-offs reflecting the idiosyncrasies of the two states, or does it signal a systemic problem for the CDU and its companion party, the CSU? Now, on the latter score, I should point out that Merkel's party has been criticized for botching the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines, for a prolonged lockdown, and perhaps most important, corruption scandals. Recently, two conservative parliamentarians resigned in the wake of allegations that they took kickbacks from mask makers. Now, the election results may really have scrambled things within the CDU. Armin Laschet was newly elected head of the CDU, and he was expected to be the candidate for chancellor. But the election results may actually have helped the leader of the CDU's sister party, the CSU, a gentleman named Markus Söder, in his bid to become the standard bearer for the right of center party in German politics. Now, German conservatives are going to have until May 23 to decide who's going to be their standard bearer. So this is something worth watching. Now, I'll just say overall that, you know, what's happening in Germany and how the elections go isn't simply a matter that affects Germans. Reality is Germany is the single most important country within the European Union, and who succeeds Angela Merkel will have major ramifications to the rest of the EU and certainly for transatlantic relations.
Tim, are we seeing any sense that from these election results, which definitely seem to be a shift leftward in German politics and put some more wind into the sails of some of the leftist parties, whether it's the Greens, SDU, or even the libertarian types, any sense that there's sort of the weariness of Merkel, as impressive as she has been and, you know, called by some the leader of the free world and so forth, that it's just sort of Germans are ready to sort of turn the chapter and as the kind of standard bearer of the party, you know, that had an impact on these results, or is that making too much?
Well, I don't have a good enough feel of German domestic politics to say how much of this is about weariness with Merkel and how much of it is the reality that she has decided to step aside and the CDU and the CSU haven't been able so far to put forward either a candidate or a platform that resonates with people. I do think there is a real possibility based on the results we saw from these two states that we could see a very different lineup in Germany going forward as a result of the September elections. There's now a lot of talk about the potential for a so-called traffic light coalition. This is the idea that you could end up having a coalition formed of the Greens, the Social Democrats, and the pro-business liberal free Democrats. Now, let me explain where the term traffic light comes from. I should note that Germans are very good at coming up with clever ways to describe their coalitional politics. But the Social Democrats, their color is red. The Greens, their color is green. And the Free Democrats, their color is yellow. Well, obviously, traffic lights are a combination of red, yellow, and green. So that's where that comes from. I should note also, you'll sometimes hear talk about the so-called Jamaica Coalition that involves the CDU, the Greens, and the Free Democrats. And that's because the CDU's color is black. And if you have a combination of black, green, and yellow, that turns out to be the colors of the Jamaican flag. But again, we're going to sort of see this long time between now and the national elections in September. A lot of things could happen. A lot could depend upon what happens with COVID-19, the ability of the government of Germany to handle it, and also whether or not we see more stories about corruption in the governing party, which obviously is always bad news for any party that hopes to continue to retain a lead in a country's politics.
Yeah, and I would just add the aspect of the far-right AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, their seeming defeat in the regional polls was very interesting, and it makes one think further about whether or not the migration issue is resonating in Germany anymore, or at least this year.
On that, I think people would point out that the AfD's support is even stronger in Eastern Germany, and we haven't seen those voters go to the polls yet. So let's put a big question mark on that for now.
Fair enough.
Bob, it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figures of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected Europe Halts AstraZeneca. What can you tell us about this choice for audience figure of the week?
Well, Jim, as you alluded to in the discussion of German politics, there is concern about the vaccine rollout. And that concern was compounded when you started to see a few reports from Germany and other countries that some people who had taken the AstraZeneca vaccine developed blood clots. Now, this is not a large number. The company says that out of 17 million doses given in Britain and Europe as of March 8th, there were only 37 instances of blood clots. And some would say that it's a huge overreaction to say that the vaccine caused this, that these could have occurred and quite likely did occur in any event, because certain things will happen, health incidents will happen in populations that are being vaccinated regardless, that the vaccines are set up to stop this particular infection and have proven really effective at that. You've had European health regulators have said it's not right to halt these vaccinations, it should be going ahead, and that further reviews are expected. And actually, as we're taping this podcast, there was expected to be a new decision coming out from the European health regulators about the AstraZeneca vaccine, but that these regulators have already indicated they should continue to be rolled out. But we have Germany, Italy, Spain, Ireland, and France among countries now that have suspended the vaccine. A few have gone deliberately in the other direction. Obviously, the UK, which has a very strong record of vaccination right now, far exceeding the rest of Europe. Greece has also decided it is going to continue with those vaccinations. But as I said, it adds to this sense of dread in Europe, which is dealing with a virulent third wave. It looks like a third wave of the coronavirus, and very low, comparatively low distribution rates, in some places less than 10% of population. And again, you have the UK, which is much farther than that. You have the United States, which is up at like 22% or so. At last reported, 22% of people had gotten at least one of the vaccinations needed. And so concerns about European bureaucracy, maybe an overabundance of caution, ineffectiveness in sort of securing the right supplies. There's now talk about the Europeans blocking exports of vaccines that are actually produced in Europe, but then sent abroad under agreements that they will then stop that and invoke some 50-year-old rule that would allow them to do so. So it's a really tense time on the vaccine front in Europe, Jim. And AstraZeneca is, according to many experts, seen as sort of a fall guy when it's really it's a far bigger sense of problems that are in Europe.
Certainly the case, Bob. I will just note two things. One, the handling of the vaccine rollout is going to have reverberations in national politics. We just spoke about Germany. I don't think it's simply Germany that's going to be roiled by this, but it's also going to have big consequences for the European project, for Brussels, for the idea of the European Union. And the question is, will it lead to greater efficiencies and finding ways to better coordinate? Because on health issues, it's really individual countries going their own way, which is part of the problem here. So do you get better coordination and the like, or does it lead to even more pulling apart as countries each try to sort of protect themselves and are more skeptical of what Brussels is and what Brussels does? Now, we've been talking about this for a number of years. The European Union, that project, has sort of been the big idea in Europe for a long time, and it continually encounters obstacles. And the question is it going to go forward, or are we going to see it begin to go backward? And I think the jury is still out on that very big question.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is set to visit India, and a presidential election is scheduled to go forward in the Republic of Congo.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.